Not going to meta practice, I'm sorry. I see that you were all ready for it, but we thought with Battelle maybe it would be nice if for the last evening there was a talk that tried to put everything together that we've seen for this week, and also a little bit speaking about practice in daily life, or what it means, so that there is some kind of transition. So sorry for the metta, but you can still stay after this talk and practice metta. No problem. And before I start giving this talk, first I would like, on my name and on Battelle's name, thank you for your support. Thank you very much. So now everybody is reorganized for the new event. Okay. So often at the end of a retreat, some people ask, so how can we continue the practice in daily life? And the question is very interesting, because usually what people mean, how can I continue the practice in daily life? It means, how can I continue the practice of meditation in daily life? As if the spiritual path was just being reduced to the practice of meditation. And then either I can do some sitting, can steal half an hour every morning and keep on practicing, or if I cannot steal that, then I don't practice anymore. And I think there is something mistaken there. And maybe is the responsibility of the way we are teaching. Of course, when we come to 1 week of meditation, we really want to speak about meditation and practice it so that we can learn and develop the sensitivity for it. Makes sense. Yet we have to explain how meditation is only one part of the spiritual path. Although now meditation is quite in fashion, I guess in Israel, like it is in Europe, the newspaper everywhere, the radio and television, sometimes they interview somebody about meditation. It's quite amazing. Imagine when I came back from India in 1972, meditation was something very strange for the hippie going to India, but otherwise not something that you speak about at the radio or the television. Nowadays it seems that there's a lot, so it's quite in fashion, and there's a little bit of danger that it is cut from the meaning of a spiritual path. It becomes just some kind of technique, which is fine, it can be useful for something, yet the way we are practicing, which is quite, in a sense, rigorous, it's really to be seen in as part of a spiritual path. Now, when I say a spiritual path, it does not necessarily mean Buddhist spiritual path, yet in something deeper than just looking for a well-being. So it doesn't need to be a Buddhist path, but deeper, I think, than just well-being. I think it answering a need deeper in human nature. Yet, of course, here I will speak in the Buddhist context, but it is very easy to translate in any other context. The Buddha said, my teaching has only one taste, like all the sea of the world have one taste, which is a taste of salt. My teaching has only one taste, the taste of freedom. And that's really what we are exploring, is freedom. Although sometimes it's not so clear. When we meditate, we wonder where's the freedom. It seems that we are more and more closed in sometimes in our practice, yet still the meaning is we are practicing for freedom. That is important not to forget about it. And the spiritual path also, in this other aspect that I'm going to speak about tonight, it's also about freedom. And we will see that there are many aspects that we can really explore in daily life, having in mind, again, that it is really for freedom. And often we choose the wrong decision, the one that does not go in the direction of freedom. And we are conditioned by that, not seeing what is more important, what is essential. So the way the spiritual path is explained in the Buddhist tradition can be in many different ways. One way is to speak about what we call sila, samadhi, and prajna, which means morality, concentration, and wisdom. That's one way. Another way is through the Eightfold Noble Path. Another way. And another way is through the three essential aspects of the practice. And it's what I will like to take tonight, or the three pillars of the practice. So I like to explain that and explore that with you. And those three pillars of the practice are generosity, morality, and meditation. So remember, they all are practice for freedom. Nothing for something else. All for the sake of freedom. So they have in common that they are for freedom, and they have another essential aspect in common, is that they all imply a letting go. They all imply a letting go in a different way, but they are imply a letting go. So generosity is not so much the wish to make another person happy. That is the work of metta that you have been exploring. That is a kindness, we understand. It is specific, the wish to make another person or oneself happy. But the aspect, the main aspect of generosity, is a letting go of attachment. And so we see what the challenge is. And that can be explored in daily life. If there is no letting go of attachment, there is no practice of generosity. So that's quite important. And I think we know that, in a sense, if you give something that you don't want anymore, or something that does not work, the other person is not going to say you are so generous, you know. You're just getting rid of this old stuff that you don't want anymore, you know. Ah, oh, so kind of you. It doesn't work. I think we are not mistaken. But if there is something that you really like, and then you are willing to give it to someone, and there is a letting go of the liking and attachment you had for that, and then the person understands that is an act of generosity. So you see how the challenge is there. Can I let go of that I was clinging to? And there is one aspect, I think, if we are very mindful, attentive, there is one aspect that is very clear when we let go of that. If we don't regret it, because it will be not an act done very skillfully, there is always a sense of freedom. We believe, I lost that, but I lost a burden, because I was attached to it. Suddenly we discover, oh, that's fantastic, I can live without, and I'm not being burdened by that. So that way we can explore that there is some freedom in the letting go of attachment. Attachment, we believe that we possess things, but in the attachment, the things are possessing us. We have plenty of examples. I was going to take men and cars, but I have no cars, but I imagine sometimes it's so meaningful for some men and maybe some women, this attachment to the car, you know, is so important. Then the person is being possessed by the car, not the contrary, or whatever it can be. So in this letting go, there is one is freeing oneself from being possessed. I remember when I was in India many years ago, I met two Frenchmen. They had come from France by hitchhiking, and they started with $100 in their pocket. So of course they had spent everything when they reach India. And they were just there in the street and getting some help from people. And at this time they were living in a park, sleeping in Delhi. And one had a watch. So he said, I'm going to sell my watch. He sold his watch and asked all the people, the 40 people, come on and let's go and eat. And then they just ate. was not, he was not attached. He had so little that it was not difficult for him not to be attached. So there was a sense of freedom there. He said, we don't need to worry. That's okay. We find food. And it seems suddenly as we have a little bit more, then I have to be careful. But that was such a beautiful teaching that he did not sell his watch and say, we can last for 1 week. No. Call all the friend, come and let's go and eat, you know. And I think that was beautiful, seeing that there was some freedom in that. So what can be given is, of course, material things. It is simple. But there are many other ways to give, and also many other ways where we can see that we can be grasping, giving of our time to help another person, of our skill, giving of protection. All they imply letting go of my own comfort, my time, my knowledge or whatever, and the giving of teaching, as I've spoken this afternoon. All those ways are ways of giving. And we are sometimes being challenged. I've not walked very much in the street of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but I imagine you also have beggars. We've actually quite a lot in Switzerland, and even more in France. So it's always interesting to meet people that are begging. So what then is my relationship? How do I react to people begging? Sometimes they can do it in a very demanding way. First reaction is, I don't want to give because those people are so much demanding. You know? I prefer to give to someone who is not so much demanding. And I've seen in India so much so that some people give to people who don't ask and don't give to people who ask, you know. Or they give to children, they come with their pen and give to the children that do not ask for anything. So next time they will ask for something. So transforming those children in beggars. But when beggars ask, they don't give. Like, I don't like to be asked, you know. I should choose, you know. Or to give to a beggar who is smiling and not to one who is not smiling. It's, you know, this is a nice beggar, he's smiling, I give. This one is not, no, I don't give. You know? So this way of making difference, you know. But in the action of giving, there's something much more important than material things that are being given. Something much more important. The tendency of protection to not give is to disconnect oneself from the other. The Spanish song that says there is nothing like poverty to be invisible. Somebody's poor, you know, begging. Nobody sees. People go in the street and suddenly they just look on the other side, you know, come to the, just when the beggar is, they look on the other side, something is so interesting there, and then they go, you know. I remember in Milano, there was one young man playing the violin, beautiful. And people would go by, and nobody would stop. Only I could see when children would come and take their parents by their hands and look at the players, then the parents would come, and they give a coin for good education of the children, you know. So much so for the beggar, but this way of not wanting to be challenged. There's a way which is very dramatic and very serious, which is to transform the beggars in another class. They are not full human being, you know. So what they can be drug addict. A drug addict, not really. So they are a specific species, you know, drug addict, or foreigners, or there are many ways just to transform them. They are not full human being. This is a way, so I'm not being challenged, you know. And in this way, when we give, it means that we are not only giving some material things to the people, but also giving them their own humanity. We recognize them. You are a full human being. And when there is this happening, and it is amazing how suddenly one may feel there is a true human relationship there, much more than in many, many encounters in daily life. If I go to the store and I pay for what I took, the salesman or saleswoman are not going to say it's so nice of you, you know, well, better pay, because it's just something that need to be done. There's a contract there. But when you give to a beggar, you are completely free. And the beggar know that. He know that you are not obliged to give, that you have chosen to give. And there is, in this encounter, there is something very deep in the recognition of two human beings. It doesn't go in one way only. That's not that you suddenly recognize this beggar, and sometimes they can be in a poor situation. There is true that some drunkards sometimes in a bad shape, some people smelly and so on. Of course, if they were, you know, with nice suit and attaché case, they would not be begging, so they are in a difficult situation. There's no doubt. No doubt about that. But suddenly when you recognize beyond that, it's a full human being there. Then at this time he also recognizes you as a full human being. It's something quite amazing that happened. I remember once in the south of France, I think it was 10 in the morning in Avignon, and there were two men there begging, and they were drunker. They certainly had already drunk. I don't know if they had a bottle of wine in front of them, but they did not seem to be very clear. So they had written something. So as I passed by, I stopped and I gave them something. And suddenly they looked at me and they were not anymore dull or unclear. You know, they said, thank you. And I could see that they were completely there this time. Before they were just gone, and suddenly they were there and they said, thank you. And in many times when I explore that, always I'm struck that there is something so deeply meaningful for a human being, much beyond the small amount of money that can be given. There's something much more important. So letting go, you know, it's amazing how people can find excuses, as I said, to put people in a category which is so dangerous, but also excuses, very poor excuses. You know. We cannot give to everyone, therefore you don't give to anyone. You know. This is quite strange. One cannot give to everyone, then one doesn't give to anyone. It is so strange, and I'm even not sure it's not possible to give to everyone. If I count how many beggars I will meet in Geneva if I go through the city, I'm sure I will not meet so many that I could not give a small coin to each of them. I will not be in a poor situation. So here, we explore freedom. We explore freedom. It's quite important to explore that. Now, it doesn't need always, we don't need always to give, and sometimes it's wise not to give, it is true. Sometimes we see that maybe the person is going just to get another bottle of wine or whatever, although usually it's too late to tell them, please don't drink, because that's in the state in which they are, it's much too late. But yet, we understand sometimes maybe skillful not to give, yet we can always establish this human relationship. This is always a possibility. It's not a problem. Say hi. It's already so amazing. If we imagine we were beggars and all the people walking, usually they are seated, so people are walking, they are standing and not looking at you. You just do not exist. And when some look at you, it can be with some kind of dismissing. So imagine at the end of the day, when you have seen so many people passing by, you know, not looking at you, you don't exist, you are not a human being, and those who look at you, like if they were looking at a dog, not even usually dog, they like them, so they don't look at you, even like if you were not deserving respect. Can you imagine? Suddenly you have one person there, even if this person doesn't give, but interact, recognize, oh, there's a human being there. You know? Okay, hi. So that is already so nourishing, and often more needed even than the money. I know in some city, I know in Boston, for example, if some friends taking care of the homeless, there is plenty of help, it's not the problem, but the human relationship that is different. So you see the space for freedom? It's there in the street. It's not that, oh, I could not do my sitting for half an hour, forget about it. And so I think the teacher are a very nice teacher. They just show us where, exactly where we are, you know. Wow, it's such a good meditation. I spent a week really deep meditation, and you go there and you just dismiss all the beggars. Where is the deep meditation? Where is the deep meditator? I remember once living in San Francisco, I went to a Dharma talk evening, so listening to a beautiful teacher, giving a beautiful lecture in a big hall. And of course the beggars knew, so they were all outside when people came out, you know. And I looked, and very few people gave. I was amazed. Maybe they are given while going in, I'm not so sure, but I saw very people giving. So it's so amazing. We want to grasp at something, a beautiful Dharma talk, but the beggars, you know, they are not part of our life and spiritual life. This responsibility that we have. Now, of course, not only with beggars, we have other people that may request our help in our job, in our family, many, many ways. It doesn't mean that we don't know how to make a limit, but yet always being open and seeing where the clinging is, where the attachment is. If you look at people, if you sit at a coffee in shop and you look at the people going by, a beggar, it's very interesting. It is very clear to see where freedom is and where freedom is not, you know. Some people come and, dismissing or pretending not to see, or people speaking together, being so busy that they cannot stop for 3 seconds to see the beggar, you know. And then suddenly you see one person stopping, and there's something completely different. It's completely different. There's another world. So that's part of our spiritual path, and that's part of the development of freedom. So not only in sitting meditation. So that for the first aspect, it's a beautiful, beautiful to explore. Second aspect of morality. So it's a letting go of what? Letting go of the wish to harm another person. So that is clear in this sense, that if there is no wish to harm another person, there is no morality. So if one were to live alone in a cave or in the desert, then there is little opportunity to practice morality, because there is little wish to harm another person, because there is nobody else. The wish to harm oneself will also be against morality, but there is less opportunity. And it is said, like a Buddha or somebody awakened cannot practice morality anymore because there is no wish to harm another person. It makes sense. It makes sense. It's a letting go of something there. So if there is already all the letting go of all the aversion and hatred, then there is no practice of that. We can say it's expressed then in a different way, in kindness and so on. So letting go of the wish to harm another person. Now we know there's a list of things not to be done, you know, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to slander, not to abuse another person, many ways. So the list usually are 10 things, but this is a morality of restraint, which is important, is basic, and we meet that in all societies, and it makes sense. But often we are not aware the consequence of small things can happen. The simple slandering of another person, you know, it's amazing how when we hear about the good quality of a person, we may doubt it. Is it true, really? We want to check. But when we hear about the bad quality of a person, we believe it immediately, you know. I was sure, you know. I was sure this person. It is amazing. I think we are all like that. We're so prone to believe, yes, I was sure there was something wrong there, you know. But this is very serious. I remember in France, one politician was really slander, calumny by the media and other, to the point that he committed suicide, you know. But he had not done anything wrong. He was just pushed by this kind of, you know, the media can be sometimes so bad, you know. Of course, political fight, but it seemed that anything was acceptable in politics, and that was not. I think it did for a little while shake a little bit the establishment, wondering that if they were not also in politics and morality to be respected. I don't think it lasted very long, but at least. So we see that a small slandering of a person can have a very strong effect on many things, and on the job of this person and on the life of this person. So we need also to be aware of sometimes a very simple way to suggest that something may be wrong, you know. We don't go so far saying there's something wrong, but maybe there's something wrong already there. We are starting to bring prejudice to another person. So being aware of sometimes those subtle ways that we may wish to harm another person. Sometimes it's so subtle that we even are not aware that thing's happening. So the morality of restraint, we understand, but I think it's not enough. Although in the early Buddhist tradition, it's really very much about that, the morality of restraint, I think that the Buddhist tradition later understood that it is not enough, we need something more. And then in the later tradition, in Mahayana Buddhism, and they were the ideal of a bodhisattva of really taking responsibility for the suffering of other. That need an opening to the other, not only not doing harm to other, but also really being engaged with other in a more positive way. And I think in the 21st century, even in the Buddhist tradition, we cannot just be satisfied with the morality of restraint. It is not enough. We need really a morality of responsibility, much more demanding than not just not harming another person. So the notion of responsibility seems to be very important. And I have the feeling that nowadays it's something that is less and less taken in account. I don't know if it's part of the education. It seems media adults and children do not understand what is responsibility. Not valuing it. Like if it would be something like old-fashioned or burdensome. And here I would like to explain or describe how taking responsibility is not a letting go, so to speak, but is a way to be fully mindful of what one was doing. When one takes a full responsibility of what one is doing, then there is a full being there in what one is doing. So there's a strong sense of that. So I think it's part of or help or part of a mindful way of being alive. I'll try to illustrate that in a few ways. And it gives, taking of responsibility for one's own action, for one's own life, it gives some power and a good sense of being really alive, being really here for one's life. Not pretending one is not alive, you know, it's just living just like that, you know, in a distracted way. Not taking responsibility to be alive. It's a very strange way that we as human beings can do. Avoiding to be fully alive. So taking responsibility is really to be fully here. So I've taken a few stories from Martin Buber, the Way of Man, which I think is so beautiful. I don't know if they will help to illustrate what I'm trying to do, but the story are nice, so anyway. So he's quoting some, you know, wise man, some tzaddik, and here one says, he says, God does not say, this is a way to to me, but some other are not the way to me. He doesn't say, this is the way to go to me, and this is the way that does not go to me. He said, God does not say that. He said, whatever you do can be a way to me, providing that this way leads to me. Beautiful way, you know. Any way can be a way that leads to me, providing it leads to me, which means it depends the way one is doing it. A full way of doing it, not fooling, this is not the way and this is the way, you know. So I try to express that. So he's telling another story of the disciple of the tzaddik of Lublin was fasting from one Sabbath to another Sabbath. And then on Friday afternoon, he was so thirsty, so he said, I really want to drink. He went to the well to drink some water because really that's what he wanted. So he went by the well, and as he was about to drink, he said, but it's really stupid. There's only a few hours left. So he said, no, I'm not going to do it because I want to keep my fast up to the end, you know. So as he was going away from the well, he thought, wow, I really did it. It's so fantastic. I was able to protect my fast for this week. And then as he saw that he was proud about it, he said, no, that is not good to be so proud about that. So he went and he went to drink the water, so not to hold to his pride. But as he bent over the well to take some water, suddenly he was not thirsty anymore. So in the evening when he went to the tzaddik, his teacher, and then when his teacher saw him coming, he said, okay, he said a word in English which I did not understand, I had to check. He said tinkering. Tinkering is like childish play, you know. It was just childish play. It was not really a good action. And Martin Buber was wondering, he said, this tzaddik is very hard with his disciple. Why? He was so strong, and he was honest, and he was even ready to drink the water, not to hold on to his pride. And his teacher just says, childish play, you know, saying, why did he say that? So Martin Buber, trying to reflect on that, he said, because whatever, he had to do it completely. And he was wavering. He was not doing this, not doing that, not drinking. So that what the master was pointing out. If you do something, do it completely. Assume the responsibility. But he neither did he drink, neither did he keep to the end. So he said, do it completely. And I think that's very interesting, this notion of do something completely. So then there's a power, there's a responsibility of what you are doing, and then there's a quality of presence there. And I like to quote a theater director, Grotowski, Polish director, that was an amazing director, working with actor, did a lot of research, and it's interesting, I'm quoting him here now, because he loved Martin Buber, actually, he read all the book of Martin Buber, and he said that he really took a lot from him, so here we'll see that there is something of the same flavor. He said that when he was giving a workshop, I think it was in the US, many students asked at one point, when are you going to teach us the Grotowski technique for theater? You know, they wanted his technique. And he said, I have no technique. You know, he said, you are asking a technique in order to hide behind the technique. You want a technique to hide behind. He said, you have to choose now if you want to reveal yourself or hide yourself. You know, what do you want to do? And he said, how does one reveal oneself, has done one not hide oneself, is by doing completely what one is doing. So we can understand, speaking to actors, do completely what you are doing, so you reveal yourself, not hiding yourself behind a technique. So to act with the totality of oneself, it's taking the responsibility for one's action, to do it completely. not pretending one is not doing it, doing it completely. Another quotation from Dostoevsky said that everyone is responsible for everything and for everyone. I more than another. So there's a sense of responsibility, not so much responsibility for what was done in the past, but responsibility to really engage one's own freedom in choosing what to do. And we can see that how often we would like to put the responsibility of something on other, you know. It's just another. We see that in ecology or in many things. Just what can I do, you know? But I am responsible more than another. So to really start to do it myself, to assume my own responsibility, and that give power to the action, that give presence to the action, then one is really doing them, not halfway doing and halfway not doing them. So in this sense, the taking of responsibility, I think, helps this sense of doing completely what we're doing it, and also engaging one's own responsibility. In some project, in something that one can assume the responsibility. And I think that's important. A few of you have mentioned sometimes, well, if we are just with meditation, then with this attitude of to be with what is there, so we never do anything. And I think it's important to see when we are meditating and trying to be open to what's happening within us, but doesn't mean that in life we never take responsibility. That would be mistaken. On the contrary, we need to take responsibility, but clearly being aware of what's happening and engaged completely in what we're doing. So I think this morality of responsibility is important. It gives a sense that we're doing completely what we're doing. And also we're capable of engaging our own freedom, not just to stay led back, you know, not taking part in anything, because it's still a choice. Then we need to assume it completely. There will be much more to say about responsibilities. It's certainly a very complex attitude that we could explore. Here's just a few reflection on it, and that each one of you in your own situation can reflect on the meaning of responsibility. And seeing very clearly the power that it gives to one's action. It's very different if one is not doing it completely than if one is doing them completely. The power and then the presence it gives to our action. Again, it goes in the sense of freedom. So the third pillar is meditation. Of course, we have spoken a lot during this week about meditation. I will just say a few words. So we have seen that there are two types of meditation. There is samatha and vipassana. Samatha is a calming of the mind, and for that we need to hold on to something stable that will help to calm the mind, and that is a skillful way to bring tranquility in the mind. And the other is vipassana, clear seeing, practice that helps to see very clearly our experience, our life. Clearly means not to hold on to opinions, to concepts, to ideas, but to really see the situation for what it is. So the letting go in this case is letting go of confusion. So we are three letting go, letting go of attachment in generosity, letting go of the wish to harm, hatred, anger, whatever, and now the letting go of confusion. In a sense, it's more subtle. That's why in meditation we need a quiet situation that we can see very subtle aspect of confusion. In a sutra, a monk asked the Buddha, he said, when one is lost in suffering, in difficulties, in confusion, where is the island, where is the refuge? Island and refuge here means where is freedom, where is awakening. So this monk is asking a very simple question. In essence, what is freedom? When one is not free, so when one is bound by suffering and difficulties. So what it means, freedom? And the Buddha answer, he said that not grasping. That is the island, not grasping, that is a refuge. Not grasping. And the great teacher, Marcy Sayadaw, said, why do we meditate? In order to not grasp. The only reason is in order not to not grasp. And we'll find quotation in the Zen tradition, Tibetan tradition, in all the Buddhist tradition, and even in other tradition, the same way of expressing it. Why do we meditate? In order to not grasp. That's why we meditate. If we sit in silence, having pain in our knees, sitting in a strange way and all that, and being the way we are in retreat, it is only to not grasp. For no other reason. So whatever is helping us to not grasp, that goes in the sense of freedom. So there are various practices in the Buddhist tradition. Some, even if we speak about the Tibetan visualizing mandalas and deities, it's so complex. Why is it done? In order to not grasp. And they are very clear about it, that they would not be mistaken and give us some other motivation. It is in order to not grasp. Of course, they work in a slightly different way, but finally it just comes down to that, in order to not grasp. But what does it mean to grasp? I mean, wonder, okay, that why not, if not to grasp is freedom, okay, I will not grasp, so tell me what is grasping, then I'll stop, you know. Yeah, I understand, yes. So what is it, grasping? Not grasping with hands, that will be easy, just open their hands. Or not grasping with the teeth, that will be also easy. But the way we grasp, of course, is with our mind. So that we learn in our meditation, we bring a situation that will help us not to grasp with our mind. But now, how can we grasp with our mind? The mind has no hand. So how can it grasp? Those are so important questions. If we don't understand, it's difficult to understand how meditation is unfolding. So how does a mind grasp? So if we take the example of a sunset, sunset is there, I can see it, and I know it's changing and it's disappearing. It's gone. I cannot hold it, I cannot stop the sun, stay there, just I go and get my camera, take a picture, it's not possible, that it's going, it's just changing, and it's gone. So how can I grasp at that side, this experience, by making a concept, an image of it? Then I can, if we are allowed to speak, and I can say it while eating the food, wow, there was such a beautiful sunset tonight. I grasp it. When it was there, I immediately grasp it. I made substitute of the sunset, which is an image of it, and that I can keep. So the grasping is always a transformation of any experience into a substitute, and we keep the substitute. And this is how memory is gone. Our mind is full of memories of those grasping things that we had and that we can keep. That is a what is interesting in grasping, is that we can keep. And it's a good thing. If we could not grasp and keep anything, we could not function. So this is not a mistake of the way we function. The problem is that then there is a confusion between that which is grasp and the live experience. Finally, as we are seeing the sunset and we immediately make this concept, is there. Suddenly we take the concept for the sunset. And then we don't really experience a sunset very clearly. There's this concept. We see what we believe, not what we see. As I mentioned, if we come in the meditation hall, every step we see something different, yet we believe I am exactly in the same meditation hall. But the experience is completely different. So we see here, I substitute my experience of seeing with the concept of meditation hall. Therefore, I am walking in this hall, which is completely the same. But my experience is different at every step. Here, there's a very clear substitution of the concept of the hall that is substituted to the experience of seeing. Again, it's not a problem. But when I take this substitution for the reality, that is what I am seeing, and therefore I'm cut from reality, and there's a grasping. Grasping to sunset, to meditation hall is still okay. There are things that are much more intense, and we grasp even with more certainty. So that's the way we grasp through concept. And the meditation, in order to not grasp, is to get close to the experience, so close that there is not anymore the concept. Let's say to get close to the seeing of the sunset, so that I am not holding to the concept, but just be with the experience of seeing. And there is something different in my experience of just seeing. Or as we have spoken, with hearing, I'm just with the experience of hearing, not holding to the concept of the track or whatever, and there is something very different in this experience of hearing. Something that is, my being is being revealed to itself in this experience of hearing, because there is no grasping. Same for us in the bodily sensation. Can make image of the body or evaluation, judgment, this sensation, that sensation, naming and clinging to the name. But when I get just to the experience of the bodily sensation, just that, then at this time there is no grasping. It's just the experience. Satipatthana, which is what we are practicing, and Satipatthana Sutra means the placement of attention very close to the experience, in such a way that there is no distance anymore. That what we are practicing Satipatthana for the sake of Vipassana. If you want to get clean the word, Vipassana is a result, is a clear seeing, the clear seeing that come when we stay very close to the experience, that there is no distance between the experience and the experiencer. Then there is no distance in which the concept can be there, and at this time there is no grasping. It's Vipassana, and it's freedom. So not that we start to fight against the concept, the substitution. We just try to be as close to the experience as we can. To be as interested with the experience as we can. This hearing, I don't care about the track that I'm hearing or whatever, but what is this hearing experience? Then I get close, and then something there. When there is no concept, I can discover there is another quality. That we call really mindfulness, when there is this quality. Same with seeing, same with bodily sensations. And as we have also described, it can be the same with emotions or mental states. Again, I'm selling you sleepiness, but not the same. You know, you can also have this quality, and sleepiness, suddenly there is no grasping, there is no concept of it, it's just a full experience of it, and there is freedom in that. So all our job in Satipatthana, so to speak, or in Vipassana, is to stay as simple, as close to the experience as we can. And as soon as we react, we don't want it, we want something else, then we put at a distance. The judgment that we put, it is good or bad, it could be better, this is a distance, this evaluation is a concept, and we cannot really be in touch with the experience. So that in a nutshell, if you like, the spiritual path in the Buddhist tradition, again, we find very similar expression in other tradition. Not grasping, to be free, to be very close to one's life, so that we know it intimately, without any opinion and judgment. We experience it in intimacy. So we can experience that in daily life, as a morality, generosity, but also this letting go of confusion. We can see sometimes there is opinion, there is judgment in life, we're discussing with another person, and it's sometimes possible just to see, I'm clinging here to my belief, to my opinion. It's just my opinion. It's not a truth. So when we start to be aware of that and be able to let go of that, we feel there's a freedom. I'm defending my opinion so strongly in a meeting. Yes, I'm right, and this like that. And suddenly, I realize I can also let go of that. Fine. I feel there's so much freedom in that. It doesn't mean that I will not defend my point of view if it is important to take a decision. It's not about that. I will say always yes to the other. No, but when there's this fight of opinions, that's fine. If I let go of it, there's an element of freedom. And often I can find at this time, as I'm not grasping at my opinion, it's another way of seeing the situation and even expressing it sometimes that completely change the dialogue with the other person. So there's plenty of opportunity in our daily life also to explore that. Okay, so that was just to try to put everything together and how to practice in daily life is not only meditation, is a spiritual path.